Moretti,
yes.
who is a ray of sunshine in this book. We've got Longmire, who's old and tired, a little depressed. I mean, he has a tendency to slow down.
Yeah.
And Henry Standing Bear, who doesn't use contractions. And into this thing comes this ray of sunshine with the filthiest mouth you ever want to hear. And she's delightful. She's such a terrific counter... whatever the word is.
There's an energy that comes from, you know, an urban voice like that. And I had spent, you know, I mean, I'm not, you know, metrophobic like that. I mean, I actually have, you know, lived in a number of larger cities and I really enjoy, you know, the energy from those cities and the voices from those cities like it. And so I thought, okay, if this is going to be a rural book like that, you know, maybe what I need to do to kind of like, you know, give it a spin a little bit more and ratchet things up a little bit more is to have a little bit of an urban voice in there somewhere. And so, she was an immediate construct came to mind like that. And I started thinking, okay, well, you know, if I want a construct character that's going to counterbalance Walt's voice, because
what do you mean a construct character?
Well, I knew that, like, you know, with that first person masculine voice, I was going to have something, you know, that, that maybe was not someone that I knew, that was someone that I could construct, you know, that I could
make
to help counterbalance that voice of the narrative like that. And I thought, well, okay, you know, let's look at this, you know, in a logical manner here. Okay, Walt is male, you know, she's going to have to be female. Walt is older, she's going to have to be younger. Walt is rural, she's going to have to be urban. You know, Walt is very careful about the type of speech that he uses and things that he says. She is profane. Like that.
That's amazing.
I was able to take all of those things and kind of put them together and was very, very happy with the results like that, because the character, you know, works very, very well.
Well, you should be, because what happens is that the listener or the reader begins to wait for that car to come back. You know that the operative event is happening, but you want to see what Vic's reaction to it will be, how Standing Bear's going to get Walt out of this mess.
Well, and one of the things that happens, like that, it's so funny you should mention that, like that, because in The Dark Horse, like that, there's an instance, you know, where a kind of evangelical insurance adjuster, you know, is trying to talk Walt into going out into this other, you know, county to take a look around. And, of course, you know, Vic comes in and sits on the other side of Walt like that. And, you know, he acknowledges her like that, you know, but he makes some remark about the burning barn like that. And Walt says something about, you know, well, maybe your boss, you know, missed with one of his lightning bolts. And he said, well, my boss doesn't damn well miss. And he leans, of course, forward. And says to Vic, you know, if you'll excuse my language, young lady, well, you can hear that train coming a mile away.
Absolutely.
You know, so anybody that's been reading the books knows what's going to happen next. You know,
it was perfect setup.
And that's kind of nice, because it leads to a, you know, like a high context kind of relationship, you know, with the reader, which is something I think that, you know, that you can take advantage of with a series of books, you know, because when I wrote The Cold Dish, it was a standalone book. It really wasn't supposed to be a series. And
it had to be.
Well, and the president of Penguin sat me down, Catherine Court, like that, and she said, we would really, you know, like some more of these.
Absolutely.
And I said, well, I'd be happy to write some more books for you. And she patted the arc of The Cold Dish, and she said, we would like some more of these.
Right. Well, because it yearns for it. The characters are so real, believable, so colorful. And you mentioned before the idea of human nature, other than your understanding of human nature, Walt's understanding of human nature is unbelievably good.
You.
His deep and his patience and somewhere his smarts. He just knows what's going to happen instinctively, and he can't even put into words, but he just feels that it's going to happen, it's just lovely.
It's funny you should say that, like that, because, you know, a lot of times whenever I'm doing events, you know, here in New York or in Los Angeles or in larger, you know, metropolitan areas, it's always funny because eventually someone will say, you know, wow, he's really smart for a sheriff. Like, I'm always like, well, I don't know which part of that I'm going to take umbrage with first. But I think that, you know, it adds a lot to the books like that. And I think that, you know, with the characters, you know, the development, you know, and allowing, like, you know, as we were talking, you know, allowing them to grow, I think, you know, becomes an important and essential aspect as, you know, as the series goes on.
Yeah, and they do grow, yeah.
And, you know, and then, you know, with the...
They've got you now.
Well,
those characters have you.
Oh, yeah.
And you have to listen to what they say.
I do. And even the one that you're holding in your lap there, and Candace Goes Unpunished, you were talking about Walt's, you know, actual skills, you know, as an investigator. And that was kind of, you know, one of the fomenting, you know, parts of, like, you know, taking him and dropping him off in the middle of Philadelphia,
right,
and seeing how he would do. Now, granted, I have two daughters and a granddaughter in Philadelphia, and it was just a great excuse to go eat cheesesteaks and drink Yangling long neck beer. But nonetheless, like, right. I also thought, well, how would he do? You know, how would he do? Like, I, you know, I remember the old TV show McCloud, and I remember
that's,
you know,
exactly what it reminded me of.
The other things, right, like that. But I always thought that they kind of did it with a little bit of the tongue in cheek, you know, and it wasn't a very realistic, I thought, interpretation of how a Western lawman would respond, you know, within an urban situation. Yeah. So, you know, I was curious to see what would happen with that. And, you know, and by golly, the sheriff did pretty good.
Worked well.
Yeah.
Worked well. The whole juxtaposition of him going to Philadelphia.
Yeah, and then we got to meet the rest of the entire Moretti family.
Now, what's going to happen? Is she going to marry her?
You know what? That's a really good question. Like, that's a really good question.
We're left with the possibility of Longmire's daughter marrying Moretti's son, which would make them mother-in-law and father-in-law, which
right,
is a lot of fun. Unbelievable.
So, there is a point, I think, where Vic asks Walt asks Vic and says, you know, okay, so if my daughter marries your brother, she goes, I don't want to talk about it.
Now, it must be something that you're a victim of now. I mean, you must hear their voices in your head as you dig corrals.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But then again, you know, I'm a big one, because a lot of times you get asked, you say, you know, well, what actors do you see, you know, playing these different characters? And I'll be honest, I really don't utilize actors, you know, whenever I'm you know, dividing up characters and utilizing, trying to build character or see character. A lot of times there'll be individuals that I have from my life, you know, people that I know.
Right.
And in instance of that, like that, my mother had actually read The Cold Dish the first time, like that, you know, and she called me to tell me what she thought of it.
What'd she say?
And she said, your father read it too. Like, and I said, really? Like, and she said, did he like it? She goes, yeah, he really liked it a lot. And she says, he thinks he's Walt Longmire. Now, anybody that's ever met my father, there is no one further from Walt Longmire. As a matter of fact, I used him as the older sheriff, Lucian, like that, so for that character.
Right.
But my mother said, let's not disabuse him of that, shall we? Like, so we...
Well, you hit an important point, because the more universal a character is, the more he relates to everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think Walt Longmire is me.
Absolutely.
And anybody who's going to read it is going to find some strong connection to him.
But I think also on the other side of that coin, I think that, you know, you can do a disservice, you know, by trying to generalize. I think that, you know, the more specific you are, especially emotionally and intellectually with a character, then the more of a universality there is, you know, between the reader, like that, and the character. And I do think that that is a powerful thing.
Incidentally, when it's done to a movie, Lucian is for me.
Okay. Yeah. You're far too good looking, George. I don't think we could possibly do that.
Thank you. Hey, listen, those of you who are listening to this and haven't read the first three books, you owe it to yourself to start from the beginning of Cold Dish and follow the development of Craig Allen Johnson as an author.
Well, thank you, sir.
As he goes through this. Now, what happens now? Okay, Cold Dish was finished.
Yes.
Mom said it was good.
That's right. Okay. Stamp of approval.
And what happened to the next one? How did the next one happen?
The next one came about in the sense
that was the Philadelphia one?
No, actually, that was Death Without Company. That was the Basque.
Right.
And it actually had a lot to do with the older sheriff, with Lucian, like that. And a good friend of mine, Dorothy Kissling, like that, who passed away a couple of years back, like that, one of the things she said to me that really, you know, moved that book was, she said, if you want to know why a man is the way he is, find the woman in his past.
Oh, boy. And in his past.
Yes.
Not his present.
Not his present. In his past. You know, and so I thought, like that. And I started thinking. And the older sheriff was very interesting to me. I thought, you know, okay, well, you know, I need to develop a storyline, you know, that is going to, you know, encompass, you know, his past and why he is the way he is. Like, and so that, I started thinking about the secrets in small towns, you know, and then, you know, the Basque, you know, it was just such a wonderful opportunity to introduce the entire Basque community, which runs up and down the Bighorn Mountains there in northern Wyoming into Montana. And,
that's fascinating. You know, I once did a book called The Basque History of the World.
Yes, yes. I know
have you read that?
Well, yes.
Fantastic.
I
have. And it reminded me of a lot of that.
Oh,
back into that.
And it's, it was just, you know, it was another opportunity, I guess, also to kind of show that, you know, that culture and the society of, you know, the High Plains is maybe a little bit more involved and a little more complex like that than people at first might suspect.
Yeah.
And that there are a lot more cultures out there than people might at first, you know, surmise. And so, you know, that was the gist of that book whenever I got it started. And then, you know, it was a comparison contrast piece between what was law enforcement like when Lucian used to do it, you know, back in the, you know, 50s, in the late 40s and 50s. And what was it like now? How had it changed? Like, how had the men changed? How was Walt in comparison? You know,
and you had to go back and research that.
Right? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
How did you do that?
Well, you know, I had one of the benefits of having this series out is that every Western sheriff, wants to come and talk to me and tell me stories. And I'm telling you, it's just priceless. Like, it's absolutely, I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world.
What is this story about the patrolman that stopped you?
You want to hear that one?
A little bit about fame here. What is this?
Well, I was actually doing a library event over in Meteetse, Wyoming. And that's a big town with 351 people. And so I was over there doing a library event. And how that came about was actually pretty funny, too. Like that, I got a call from Diana Chapman, who was the librarian at that point in time, like that. And she said, it was actually an email. And she said, we read The Cold Dish and we just love it and would love to have you come over and do an event. But I want to be sure that you understand, you know, here in Meteetse, we're just a branch library out of Cody and we really don't have a lot of money for honorariums or anything like that. And I wrote her back, like that, and I said, well, you know, once you reach a certain level of literary notoriety, you know, you really can't, you know, negotiate your honorarium. Mine is the same as it's always been, a six-pack of Rainier beer cans preferred.
There you go.
And I got an answer back in 3 minutes saying, you bet. Like,
sure.
And so, consequently, I do a lot of literary events in Wyoming at libraries like that, and I haven't bought beer in 3 years.
What happens in that? But you go to Meteetse, and how many people show up?
You know what? We've had, like, I went to Meteetse, and 75 people showed up for an event.
And what do they do? Do they ask you questions?
Yeah, they do, like that. And they've read the books, and they just enjoy them like that. And it's an opportunity to, talk with people who do have that high-context knowledge of what it's like in the smaller communities that I'm talking about. And so to be able to talk with them, you know, and discuss the books, you know, and the characters and all of that is really kind of a joy. But the instance you referred to earlier, like that, I have to admit, like that happened on the way back. And I was cutting back across. There's a little road that cuts off just north of Meteetse and shoots straight across to Otto and Base and some other very large towns in Wyoming of a couple hundred people. And it's like our little miniature Badlands, you know. And
right.
So I thought, you know, well, I can shoot across there. It's one of the few roads in Wyoming I haven't driven on, so I want to take advantage of it. So I, you know, went shooting across there like that, and I was driving my wife's car like that, and Judy was in the car with me, and we're going along, and after about the first 40 minutes, you know, there's just something that just automatically happens. Your foot just starts to automatically go down, you know, a little bit further and a little further. So I pop over this hill. I hadn't seen any cars on the road since I had left Meteetse. In about 40 minutes, I see this other car going the other way, pop over a hill. And I'm like, look at that, another car. And then the light bar came on that car. And I thought, oh, crap. Okay. And so I went ahead and, you know, I'd done the drill like that. And I know that, you know, with the Northern Cheyenne, you know, and with, you know, wolves and police officers, if you run, it just makes you taste better.
Right.
So I thought, all right, I just pulled over to the side of the road there like that. And I've got my license and registration out as he wheels this black Dodge Charger in behind me,
wow,
like, bristling with antenna and laser and radar and everything. And he comes, gets out of the car, and he's a young guy, about 30 years old. And I didn't used to call guys who were 30 young, but now I do. So he comes up to the car door like that, and he says, license, registration. I give it to him. Like that. And he looks at it. Like, he says, you know how fast you were going, Mr. Johnson? And I said, well, I'm hedging my bets. I'm thinking maybe I can get away with 8. Like, and I said, I think it was about 8 miles over the speed limit. And he says, actually, you were 17 miles over the speed limit. And I'm thinking, oh, boy, there goes that negotiation right there. And he looks at my ID like that, and he looks at me. He looks at my ID again, and he looks at me, and he says, I read your books, Mr. Johnson. And I look at my wife, and I go, this could go either way.
Right.
He said, no, I was a patrolman in Indianapolis, like a fellow by the name of Jim Thomas. And he says, now, you were a patrolman in New York. Like that. And we sit and we talk, have a wonderful conversation for about 4 or 5 minutes. Like that. And he says, you know, he says, well, I'm going to go back, and I'll be right back. And he takes off with my license and registration. Like that. And after about, you know, maybe 3 or 4 minutes, he comes back up and he hands me the blue warning ticket. And I will never forget the words that he said, because no matter what, you know, awards I ever win or accolades I ever get, it'll never be as good as this. He hands me the blue warning ticket with my license and says, we'd like you to slow down, Mr. Johnson, because we'd like to get some more books out of you.
That's terrific. Good man. Yeah.
Yes.
So what was the progression now? You went from Cold Dish to
Death Without Company.
Death Without Company.
And then that's when I did the Philadelphia book, like
right,
the Philadelphia story, as it were, like that. And that
and
was
your daughter's in Philadelphia.
She is,
like, and she's a lawyer.
She
too.
Is a lawyer in Philadelphia, right, like that. And so,
did you have a bad relationship with this first guy? Like,
no, I don't think so. But I have to admit, like that it was a pretty wonderful source of, you know, of information.
Fantastic.
And then I've got the Troianos, which are my entire in-laws like that from you know, from Philadelphia like that,
right.
So I had
right,
an inroad to that, you know, that
sure,
South Philadelphia Italian culture like that mm-hmm, I could use like that, which was pretty hilarious, like that, because there was even one section of the family that one of the in-family jokes that they used was there was Frank the father, Frank the son, and Frank the Holy Terror. And so then, you know, whenever I utilized that as Vic the father, Vic the son, and Vic the Holy Terror, one of the in-laws came up to me at, you know, at one of the family events and said, "That was so funny what you said about that old Vic father and son and Holy Terror thing. Where'd you get that anyway?" And I was like, I don't think I want to be the one to break the news here. Like, right. But yeah, that one was the next, and then Another Man's Moccasins was I guess the whopper, you know, I guess a
whopper. What was the event there?
That was, I actually was talking to all of these, you know, Western sheriffs like that, and I just asked them, I just said flat out, what's the worst case scenario for you guys? What's the one thing that you get involved in that's the one thing you don't want that lands in your lap? And every single one of them said the exact same thing. It was a body dump. And what that entails is that a car is going along on the highway on I-25 or I-80 or something, and I-95, okay, and you know, in the middle of the night, you know, in some desolate, you know, section of some county road or that they pull over to the side of the road, they open up the trunk and they throw the body out on the side of the road, and they close the trunk and they climb back in and drive off.
Wow!
And so there you are, you know, with no crime scene. No ID, you know, no clues as to who this person is or why this happened to them, nothing to work with. And so I started thinking, you know, well, what if Walt was to have one of those happen to him? And I was looking for a mechanism that would allow me to go back to Walt's initial experiences as a homicide investigator in the Marine Corps in Vietnam, at Tansenet Air Force Base. Like that. And
were you in the Marines?
Saigon. Actually, no, I wasn't. Right. And so I had to, you know, do a lot of research, because it wasn't like I was talking about the Crimean War. I was talking about Vietnam. So a lot of people were very intimate, you know, with this war. So I started thinking, you know, well, you know, if they did find this body and then, you know, came to find that there was actually a connection to Walt, you know, what would he do? Because there was an important point in the book, I guess, you know, whenever the lieutenant in charge of the investigation before Walt arrives, because it is their highway, but it is Walt's county. Mm-hmm. So it becomes his investigation when he arrives as far as jurisdictional application is concerned. And so when he gets there, the lieutenant from the highway patrol tells him, he says, well, you know, there's a young woman here by the culvert. And they walk down there, and he says, you know, we're checking all the Chinese restaurants down in Casper and over in Gillette and up in Billings. And Walt says, don't bother. She's not Chinese. She's Vietnamese.
Wow.
You know, from his experiences in Vietnam, you know, he knows the bone structure, and he can tell the difference immediately. And so what that does is it just starts the dominoes kind of clicking over like that, you know, and he immediately starts thinking about that first homicide investigation that he had, you know, back in 1967.
Now, how do you do it? You take notes? You have a little pad on your pocket all the time, writing down?
Yeah, that's actually what I always tell, you know, aspiring writers. I'm like, don't let a 69-cent, you know, notebook stand between you and the great American novel, like that, because, you know, we're all getting to that age where, you know, you'll have a great idea, and the next day you won't really remember what that idea was.
You'll just
remember that it was a great idea. You know?
Right. I know that's been happening. So you carry a little thing with you, a little pad or something to write down.
Well, and I'm also dreadfully guilty of, you know, my wife knows if there's a rest stop and I go into, you know, go to the restroom. If I don't come back in 20 minutes, I'm standing in there talking to someone, you know, the great thing about, you know, being a writer is that people do open up and they do tell you things like that. They do, you know, give you,
they want to be in your book.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah. Okay. but it's a wonderful opportunity to, once again, you know, be a student of human nature and find out.
Walt's grown in terms of what we know about him.
Yeah.
We've gone back into Lucian's life. We've gone back into Walt's life.
Absolutely.
And now in Dark Horse,
I was actually sitting in Larry Kirkpatrick's office like that there in Johnson County.
You're so friendly with him.
I could do ride along.
He must love these books.
Well, and the other thing is with a law enforcement background, I have, you know, there have been instances where I've been able to ride along like that. And so I have a little bit more, once again, a high context, you know, kind of relationship with a lot of the law enforcement people who actually read the books. And I think one of the things that they really respond to is not so much the technology of what it's like to do that for a living, but more of what it's like to do that for a living. You know, what's the life like?
Daily.
And I think that, you know, people respond to that. Like that. But there was an instance where I was, you know, sitting in Larry's office, and he was calling over to the sheriff in Campbell County and over in Gillette. And they're a little bit bigger county, and they have Gillette is a much larger area, like larger town. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of coal mines, you know, gas, liquefaction plants, things like that. And so it's a very busy jail over there and a very busy sheriff like that. And so I remember Larry calling over there and, you know, and asking if he, you know, could go out, you know, just kind of letting the other sheriff know that he was going to head out to the Powder River country and kind of take a look around in this one instance, you know, to see if he could, you know, see some things like that. And I remember my ears perking up because, you know, with you know, my experiences, I knew that, you know, with jurisdictional applications, you know, it can get a little dicey there, you know, with these fiefdoms. And Larry put his hand over the receiver and looks at me and says, he says he'll pay for my gas. And so that gave me a little indication as to what, you know, those things were like in Wyoming. And so
the whole thing of him handing her over to Walt.
Yes.
To, oh, I forgot her name.
Mary.
Mary.
Mary Barsads.
Because it's a kind of, that sheriff understood Walt's character.
Yes.
That if anybody could find out, it's
absolutely.
Walt.
Like, and even if he didn't have the time to be able to go out and investigate this and put the hands on, you know, the aspect of, you know, the investigation was going to need like that. He knew a guy who did. And so it was kind of nice how, you know, kind of manipulates Walt into going out there and doing this. But it was also a situation where Walt has his first undercover operation like that. And I think he makes the joke very early on like that he should have understood the inherent difficulties of going undercover in a town of 40. And
right.
So,
great. That little boy is terrific.
Benjamin.
Benjamin, mm-hmm. That whole relationship is wonderful.
Thank you.
Everything comes together. And again, the consistent thing in your writing is the contrast of characters.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's the same.
Oh, thank you.
Every person is a totally different color
and
helpful to the others, which makes a narrator's job that much easier. I mean, because you've got somebody that takes me along. I mean, it's easy to narrate when the character takes me goes. I don't have to create it.
You look for the voice. Like, I mean, it's kind of like what you were saying. Like, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the word choice has become essential. You know, because, you know, the major communication between you and I and between you and the listener, you know, and mm-hmm. between me and the reader, holy square that we've got there.
Right.
It's those words on the page. Like, and when you're able to look at those words on the page and differentiate, you know, between those characters and bring them to life the way that you do, like that, it's pretty wonderful, I have to admit.
Oh, thanks.
And I remember telling you like that, you know, people were, you know, anticipating most highly, you know, the audio version of The Cold Dish. And I remember you going, really? Like, and I was like, George, you don't have to drive 8 hours to get a loaf of bread, do you? Like, very few people in Wyoming will sit in their cars, you know, and listen to music once they get to their destination like that. But a lot of people sit in their cars in Wyoming and listen to George Waddell.
where's your next, I'm not going to say what's your next book, where's your mind going at this time for the next development in Walt Longmire? What's he going to experience?
It's, it's always social problems. It's always social implications like that. And the next book, actually, the working title for it now is called Among the Ruins. And it's kind of a modern day range war in the sense that, you know, that this was an instance that actually happened in Buffalo. And what had happened was, is that in the 1950s, there was a junkyard, you know, that was right outside of town. You know, well, then, you know, when they came through and they put the interstate system through, this junkyard was right there when you got off the exit. You know, it was the first thing you saw in Buffalo, Wyoming. Well, the founding fathers got together and they decided that was maybe not the most, you know, conducive environs, you know, for people to be spilled off into in Wyoming. And so they got in touch with the fellow that owned the junkyard, and they bought some property outside of town like that. And so they bought the property outside of town and moved his junkyard, you know, out of town. And then other people started moving into that area, you know, that was out, you know, towards where Clear and Piney Creeks are. And so there was a little bit of irritation from people out in that area. And also there was, you know, a certain ramrod attitude towards the people that owned the junkyard where they didn't want to move this time. Like that. And so in Among the Ruins, which is from the Evelyn Waugh novella, Love Among the Ruins, like that, what happens is there's a housing development, a high grade housing development that goes in very close to this junkyard, and it creates a certain amount of irritation and conflict, you know, between these two parties,
mm-hmm.
and the complications that also go along, you know, with people in a small town. And so it's kind of more of a town story this time around.
Do you have a favorite book?
You know what? I have different ones that I like for different reasons. You know, I like the plot for The Cold Dish, but I really like the humor that's in Death Without Company.
Right.
I really like the contrasts that, you know, the perspectives of Kindness Goes Unpunished, But overall, like that, you know, the storyline and the pacing of Another Man's Moccasins is the one that works for me the best. And then, you know, there are parts about the Dark Horse that I like the best. So I don't know if it isn't like trying to, like, you know, it's like your kids.
Who's your favorite kid? Sure. Yeah. It's fascinating. How does your wife work with you? You've once mentioned that you work with your wife.
Yeah, I've got this little redhead, you know, from Connecticut, you know, that I convinced to move to Wyoming, which was probably the biggest accomplishment of my life, right. You know, for gosh sakes. But she actually comes from a newspaper background. Her family were very big in the Hartford Courant. And so, you know, I'm reaping the benefits, you know, of all of her, you know, not only her formal education like that, but her particular and personal education like that, because she's a great first reader. I'm able to utilize her, you know, a lot, you know, as far as reading, you know, the stuff that I write like that. And I utilize also, you know, one of the things that you know better than anybody, that you'll catch the mistakes in a book faster by reading it aloud than you will you know, anything else. I think also you'll notice the difference in voice. If a character starts sounding a little bit like another one, if you hear it, you know, it makes a big difference. And so she reads the stuff back to me a lot of times like that. And I think that makes a big difference.
The only reason I ask that question is that when she hears this interview, I'm going to give you some points here.
Oh, okay.
You can say good things about your wife. I can't let you off with that.
I always appreciate that. Like that. Now, the other thing is when people meet her, they always ask if she's Vic. There's always
a condition.
They always ask her if she's Vic like that. And she always adamantly denies that and says she's not Vic like that. But if you've ever been in our house when there's ever been a Boston Red Sox game on.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, there's some language that comes out that I think you'd probably readily identify.
Terrific. So. Well, we're at the stage now where Vic and Walter having these having this relationship, let's say. And it's kind of nice, especially when she's back there in the bed. He's at the door and the guy is knocking on the door. In front. Listen, to the listeners, you've got to read these books because I'm having too good of a time. How can I put in words? The consistency of the books is what gets me. There's never a disappointing moment. There's never something where I'm ahead of you.
Right.
And I always look for that because once the listener is ahead of the narrator, that loses it. And once they're ahead of you as the author, then you got no reason to keep talking.
Well, I try and, like, you know, whenever I'm doing the books, I you know, people always ask that, you know, general question is, do you outline like that? And of course, you know, when you're doing something as complex as a mystery, I think you need to outline, especially one that's social commentary, you know, because you have to know who did it and why like that, because it's going to have a direct effect. One of the most powerful messages that you're giving out, you know, with a mystery is who done it and why.
Right.
And so I'm very careful about whenever I plot my books out. But then again, I'm also the first one to be open to improvisational aspects of the storyline that may present themselves, you know, as you're going down the road like that. And so I think that, you know, one of the things I try and do is stay completely open to that as I can be, because I think if you can surprise yourself, you know, if those characters, you know, can surprise you as you're writing the novel, then you have at least a chance of being able to surprise the reader. You know,
It works. One more question. Do you have another book other than Walt Longmire in your head?
Oh,
you have another The Great American Novel?
I've got a couple that I've actually even started on, like,
great.
You know, and I've got some things, you know, that are, you know, like half done, some things I've just started, you know, but they're just, you know, there's so much out there, you know, to work with, like, that.
I was thinking that maybe there should be a story about an audiobook narrator who moves out to Wyoming and he becomes, let's see, he joins the police force or something.
I had to laugh like that because, you know, when you were talking about the dalliances, you know, the sexual interludes that are in the book like that. And you know what? There really just aren't that many like that. But I had to laugh because I was doing an event in Olympia, Washington, and there was a woman that said, you know, boy, that sex scene in Kindness Goes Unpunished like that. And I said, yes, ma'am. She said, well, boy, it just... who got me all hot and bothered? Like, boy, it just went on forever. Like, and I'm sitting there really quietly, and I look at her, and I said, it was only a half a page long. Like, and it got real quiet, and I go, how many times did you read it? Like,
and then she blushed and sat
she
down.
She did, very much so.
Got to, you know, there are interesting experiences with the sex scenes in books. It was one of the times, you know, I do at this library show, someone once said to me how much they enjoy my reading of another author's work, And they go to libraries just to get a book by George Goodell. And she's just loved what my work, but this last book with all that sex in it, I was just so surprised at the filth that came from your mouth. And I tried to say it wasn't in my mouth, it was it, but didn't work. Didn't
It
work.
wasn't
Right,
mine.
so
It
I
wasn't
lost a good line.
mine. That's one of the things you have to be careful about because, I mean, you know, whenever I'm writing the books, you know, there are a couple of physical acts that you're going to be confronted with on a general basis. You know,
Right.
violence is one like that. But thank goodness, you know, the majority of people in our society like that really don't have a lot of experience with physical violence, which is a
Sure.
wonderful thing to
Yeah.
have happen. But an awful lot of them have experience with sex. And so it's one of those things where when you're writing it, you have to be very careful because it can become farcical really quick. I mean, if you do it
Yes,
well, if you
it
can
can.
write it well,
Yeah.
then it's okay to do it. If you don't, avoid it at all
Well, I was going to
costs.
ask you what research you do for that, but I don't think I'm going to go there. Well, it's just been an absolute pleasure talking with you, and you know how much I enjoy your books. I just want the people that are listening to get the same enjoyment I get out of them. So we wait for your next one with bated breath, and
Well,
thanks for coming
boy, I'll
around.
tell you what. I mean, it doesn't, you know, a week doesn't go by like that somebody doesn't write me an email and tell me just how much they enjoy the audio versions
Oh,
of
man.
my books like that.
Thanks so
And
much.
I remember whenever you know, the recently departed Tony Hillerman, good friend,
Yeah.
and whenever I won the Tony Hillerman Award, I was down in Albuquerque like that, and he said, "Well, have they," we were discussing different things like that. He said, "Well, have they signed up, you know, for the audiobook versions of your books?" And I said, "Well, yeah, they actually have." Like that, and he says, "Well, I hope you get George."
Oh, that's nice.
And
That's nice. He was a nice man,
I was
Tony.
fortunate enough
I
that
really
I
liked
did
him.
get
Yeah.
George.
Was he kind of a model for
He
you when
was, he was.
yeah.
He, and he was just an
Very
absolute
helpful guy too.
doll of a
Very,
human being.
yep.
I mean, you know, whenever you're going to meet somebody like that, you know, it's a little intimidating because you just,
Sure.
they're never, you don't never know if they're going to be as good as you hope they are. And I can say quite honestly that Tony Hillerman surpassed everything I thought he was going
Yeah.
to be.
He was one funny story. I did a library show with him one time in Michigan, and after the show, there was a signing. I was signing recordings, and he was signing books. And the line in front of the recordings was a little larger than the line in front. And he just came and said, "Hey, what is this? You know, what's that guy sitting there with all that stuff? I'm the author here." And it was just cracked everybody up. Well, listen, Craig Allen Johnson, thank you very much for coming around. And I just hope the people listen to us and read all your books and wait for the next one. So thanks
Hope so
again.
too, George. Thank you
Take
for
care.
having
Bye
me.
bye.
That was author Craig Johnson in conversation with George Goodell. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.